Montanans have mixed reactions to today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. The Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a proposed initiative to expand Medicaid to low-income Montanans. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with two experts about the impact our changing climate is having on birds. Montanans are split in their feelings about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. The nation's highest court today threw out a provision denying federal benefits to married gay couples, and in a separate decision, allowed same-sex marriage to resume in California. Both were passed with tight 5-4 majorities. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says Montana's gay rights advocates are applauding the decisions, although they acknowledge it doesn't mean much here in the state.
Jan Donaldson and Marianne Guggenheim live in a gray home near Helena's downtown. They have a high brown wooden fence and a beautiful flower garden. They're in their 60s and 70s, and they're a gay couple.
This summer is our 30th anniversary.
That's Marianne. They found out about the Supreme Court's decision to throw out the Defense of Marriage Act from Jan's son on the phone.
We actually were watching the tennis channel because
we're into Wimbledon.
They switched to a news channel.
Well, it's a joyful day.
They've often had to deal with the limitations associated with not being in a committed heterosexual relationship. Like when Marianne had hip surgery, Jan had questions and called the surgeon.
His assistant refused to talk to me because they didn't have the appropriate papers in the office to be able to share any medical information with me.
And the Supreme Court's decision to throw out DOMA does not change that.
Nothing that the court did affected Montana in any way.
That's Jeff Laslaffy, president of the Montana Family Foundation, a conservative organization opposed to gay marriage.
The decisions were extremely narrow, and Montana's marriage amendment continues to be in force, and the debate on the issue of same-sex marriage on the national level continues.
Laslaffy argues gay marriage advocates were actually losers in the Supreme Court's decision, since many were hoping the court would declare all bans on same-sex marriage unconstitutional. That did not happen. The state's gay marriage ban remains in place, and Laslaffy believes that's what most Montanans want, pointing out a nearly 70% majority voted for the ban in 2004.
I think that people in Montana still realize that the most important thing about marriage is that it provides kids with both a mom and a dad. And as a culture, and especially here in Montana, we think that's important.
However, this year, the Montana legislature did throw out the state's ban on homosexual sex. It was a historic move, coming 15 years after that law was declared unconstitutional. Public policy director of the Montana chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, Nikki Zupanic, believes even at the state level, public opinion is shifting.
Things are only moving in one direction on this issue. Whether it's legal decisions, legislation, ballot measures, everything is moving in the direction of the freedom for couples to be recognized in their relationships.
What's not fully clear at this point with the Supreme Court's decision is whether federal benefits in areas like Medicare, taxes, or Social Security would be recognized for gay couples who married in a state with gay marriage and then moved to Montana. That's all complicated and depends on the type of benefits the couple is seeking. Legalizing gay marriage may not yet be in the picture in Montana. But Jan Donaldson and Marianne Guggenheim, the couple from the beginning of this story, they are working for domestic partnership rights. They're the lead plaintiffs in an American Civil Liberties Union lawsuit against the state, looking to get some specific benefits extended to same-sex couples. That case is ongoing. They say they have a lot of work to do, but Marianne says she does not have bittersweet feelings.
Oh, really none at all. When you get to be my age, late 70s, you realize the perspective of how things often change slowly.
She says personally, this summer, she and Jan are going to celebrate their 30 years and leave it at that. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a new coalition called the Healthy Montana Initiative has filed the paperwork necessary toward getting an initiative on the November ballot that, if passed, would expand Medicaid to 70,000 low-income Montanans. The initiative effort comes in the wake of the 2013 legislature's failure to approve the expansion. Montana Human Rights Network co-director Kim Abbott is the president of the Healthy Montana Initiative. She's confident the initiative will qualify for the ballot, and that's Montanans will pass it.
We feel like Montanans care about their neighbors in the state. They want people to be able to access health care and fully participate in their communities. They care deeply about rural hospitals and clinics, and this really is an issue of financial solvency for those clinics. And we think that when they're asked the question, that they'll think this is the right thing to do.
Republican State Senator Fred Thomas of Stevensville is among the legislators who voted against Medicaid expansion, arguing that it will cost Montana taxpayers too much money down the road when the state has to pick up some of the cost. He estimates the bill could be $250 million.
That figures out a study by the University of Montana Business Center that showed that in a forthcoming session, that the 10% cost the state would pick up of this expanded Obamacare Medicaid program would cost around $250 million for the coming biennium and going forward.
Abbott disputes that argument and cites another study by the Montana Budget and Policy Center showing Medicaid expansion could actually boost the state's economy.
Having new health care dollars flow through our communities actually has an economic stimulus effect. And what we'll see is increased revenue in the state that, you know, after the first initial 3 years are over, where the federal dollars, as long as we accept them, cover the entire expanded population. As we start to pick up a small portion of the expense for the expanded population, we'll actually see added revenue coming into the state from the economic stimulus.
If the initiative passes, the 2015 legislature would still have to approve the funding for implementation. Abbott believes lawmakers would follow the will of the people and provide the funding.
A group of Montana advocates for addressing the impacts of climate change held a press conference today to support President Obama's climate change actions announced earlier this week. Former Democratic Congressman and Montana Public Radio commentator Pat Williams says Montana and other Rocky Mountain states can benefit from the president's emphasis on renewable energy development like wind, solar, hydro, and even cleaner coal.
And that means new jobs in Montana, the creation of new ideas throughout the Rocky Mountain West, new ideas about energy production, that is, throughout the Rocky Mountain West. It means challenges for people in the West to enact some changes, both in their own attitudes as well as industrial changes.
Dan Vermillion is a fly fishing guide and chairman of the State Fish and Game Commission. He says Montana has had to close rivers because of warm temperatures and low flows in 4 of the last 6 years. He says the impacts of climate change affect many businesses that depend on the sport fishing industry.
It impacts fishing guides, it impacts restaurants, it impacts hotels, lodges, shuttle drivers, gas stations, you name it, people that are dependent upon the presence of those tourists. They're affected when the tourists don't show up or they go somewhere else because our water temps are too high and we can't offer them the kind of fishing they come to Montana expecting.
We'll have more on the impacts of climate change in Montana and elsewhere later on in this broadcast.
A Missoula judge has handed down a 20-year prison sentence to a man who was convicted of driving the getaway car in a convenience store robbery in which the clerk was shot and badly injured. Today, District Judge Ed McLean sentenced 25-year-old Preston Hanna to 30 years in prison, with 10 suspended for accountability to the September 7, 2012 robbery of Ole's convenience store in East Missoula. Prosecutors alleged Hanna provided the .22-caliber rifle used in the shooting and drove the getaway car. He was convicted earlier this month. Co-defendant Christopher Birch is charged with the shooting clerk Adam Gallegos after Gallegos refused to give him money. Gallegos lost a lung and says he had his gallbladder removed recently as a result of the shooting. Birch faces trial later this year.
The State Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks plans to put up more signs to warn floaters on the Bitterroot River about a diversion dam that has proven dangerous and most recently fatal. A 6-year-old Washington State girl drowned at the site last Sunday when the drift boat she was riding in was caught in the backwater of the diversion dam and the riders were thrown in the water. Fisheries manager Pat Saffel told the Ravalli Republic the agency has ordered additional signs to warn floaters of the dangers and portage around the dam. There already are some signs in the area, but the grandfather of Jocelyn Farrell says they did not give his son enough warning to find a place to get out of the water.
A Whitehall woman was treated at Bozeman Tacona's hospital after being trapped in the Jefferson River for more than 4 hours, pinned between a canoe and a bridge pillar about 10 miles north of Twin Bridges. Rescuers from Madison and Gallatin counties responded to the Iron Rod Bridge at about 1:45 p.m. yesterday. Kelly Keller and two companions had been canoeing when the canoe became wrapped around the bridge pillar. The pressure from the current on the canoe pinned Keller's leg to the pillar. Her companions were able to help her into a position where she could breathe. Madison County Sheriff Dave Shank tells Keller was removed from the water at about 6 p.m. Emergency Management Director Chris Mumd says Keller was shaking really hard and showed signs of hypothermia.
A new report finds a variety of birds are, and likely will be well into the future, facing significant climate-related challenges. The National Wildlife Federation report, Shifting Skies, Migratory Birds in a Warming World, warns the significant shrinking of ranges, flooding of coastal beaches and marshes, and continued devastation in western pine forests by insects, all of which, the report concludes, could push some of the bird species to the point of extinction. President Obama yesterday said rules are needed to curb greenhouse gases from power plants. Prior to Obama's climate speech, Edward O'Brien spoke with sage-grouse expert Ben Diebel and the executive director of Montana Audubon, Steve Hoffman, who describes birds as one of the best windows into nature that we as humans have.
Birds are so easy to see. They're everywhere. They're in all different kinds of habitats and ecosystems. And you can see them in the middle of a large city like New York City, or you can see them up on the high alpine slopes out in the middle of the ocean. Everywhere in between, those birds are just really an important part of nature, and they're really easy to see and get to know. You can feed birds in your backyard, etc.
So they're just little billboards, basically.
They are. They're just a great way for us to feel like we're in touch with nature, be a part of nature, and also understand how nature is functioning and what kind of issues and problems we need to address.
And Ben Diebel, you're a sage-grouse consultant, right?
Yes, that's right. I started working on sage-grouse conservation about 20 years ago because it was pretty obvious even then that the bird was going to face some long-term conservation challenges. And in fact, that's come to be the case. The bird's been proposed for addition to the endangered species list, and we're continuing to lose it. We're about to lose it in states like North and South Dakota, Canada, etc.
Lose it to industrial activity or what?
Habitat loss and range contraction in general. There's been a lot of energy development in the bird's habitat. There's also been a lot of habitat loss over many decades to agricultural uses like growing wheat and corn and other things. And now climate change is just one of the latest factors we're needing to factor in.
And Steve Hoffman of Montana Audubon, what, if any, impacts is climate change right now having on the birds that Montana Audubon typically tracks?
Well, first of all, let me say that birds have a lot of stresses on them right now and have for a while, and climate change is one more. And, yeah, there's a lot we don't know about the impacts of climate change on birds, but there's some research coming out in recent years that tells us there's some warning signs that birds are going to be adversely impacted greatly, and we're starting to see that now. First of all, to preface what I'm going to say about climate change, you know, one-third of all birds in the state of Montana are declining. And about one quarter of all birds in the state are on a state species of concern list. There's 427 species known in the state of Montana, and one third are declining. One quarter of them are on the state list.
And if I can interrupt you, they're declining to what?
The rates of decline vary with the species, but some common species have declined as much as 80% over the last 40 years.
And the reason being?
Well, we think much of it is due to habitat changes, habitat loss, habitat fragmentation.
So then what sort of potential impacts could we see on these birds as the climate continues to change?
Well, just you could take wetland birds, and wetland birds are obviously going to be one of the greatest groups of birds being impacted because as it gets hotter and drier, the amount of wetland habitat is going to decline, the stream flows will be reduced, and species that are dependent on those wetland habitats are going to be in trouble. Another issue that I wanted to mention is, of course, the impact of climate on migratory birds that move into Montana in the summertime. And there was a recent study done in Colorado on the broad-tailed hummingbird over a 40-year period. And, of course, hummingbirds depend heavily on nectar for their survival. And, of course, when flowers bloom will impact their food resource. What this study determined was that one of their primary flowers, the glacier lily, which produces a lot of nectar and it's been blooming on an average of 4.5 days earlier per decade, and so that's 18 days earlier over the past 40 years, the broad-tailed hummingbirds have been arriving a little bit earlier, an average of about 1.5 days per decade or about 6 days over the last 40 years. So that's a differential of about 12 days. So already we're seeing a disconnect between when the birds are arriving and when their food resources are most available. And, of course, that's going to very likely affect their breeding success. And, of course, that's just one species of bird, but we're seeing similar patterns with other bird species as well. In terms of insect-averse birds are arriving more or less as they always have, but yet the insect abundance is moving earlier and earlier into the early part of the summer or late spring. And so there's a disconnect there for when they need to have their insect abundance to feed young and raise young each year. So that's one concern. And so one of the things that Audubon and specifically is doing in terms of trying to respond to the issue of hummingbirds is they've created a new citizen science project called Hummingbirds at Home. You can find that on the website, hummingbirdsathome.org. And it's a chance for anybody to watch hummingbirds and watch the flowers and see where hummingbirds are feeding, what they're feeding on, and when they're seeing them, and whether there's a change in the flowering time, the phenology of flowering plants on this patch of habitat that you might have in your backyard that you can monitor.
Mm. Ben, you've talked about some of the existing challenges sage-grouse are facing. What sort of additional pressures would a changing environment add to that mix?
There's a couple types of things that are particularly worrisome. One is the arrival of exotic diseases as well as exotic plants into the bird's habitat in Montana. There's a type of grass called cheatgrass that originally comes from Russia that has been invading for a long time in the states to the south of us, particularly Idaho, Nevada, and California. And the thing about cheatgrass is it makes the landscape burn more frequently. It's a grass that dries out early in the season, as the name suggests, and is very flammable. And when you get more frequent wildfires on the landscape, that kills sagebrush, which is the most important food for sage grouse. And we're now starting to see cheatgrass arrive in Montana and start to dominate some of the places like the Bighorn Mountain flanks in the southeast corner of the state, even places in the Bitterroot Valley and some of Beaverhead County, we're seeing more cheatgrass. And so it's a real concern that we might start burning the habitat accidentally that sage grouse needs the most. Also, just general drought conditions are really difficult for sage grouse. 12 of driest years on record in the West have occurred in the last 15, and we know that sage grouse in those years often won't even attempt to breed, or they'll lay fewer eggs will hatch, and fewer chicks will survive. And so you have a long-term productivity decline in the population itself.
Sounds like it's facing a real uphill struggle.
I guess I don't want to be too negative about it. I mean, there are things we can do. First of all, people need to start dumping less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Just last week, my wife and I got solar panels for our rooftop here in Missoula so that our electricity, less of it, will come from coal. But there's also land management things very specifically that can be done in places like sage grouse habitats. We need our agencies to plan for drought rather than be surprised by it. We need to have better regulations put in place for how we produce energy, because there's things we do on the landscape that fragment these habitats and make them more vulnerable to change by drought. there's really a whole range of things that we can engage, and I consider it an opportunity, not something to stay home about.
I don't know who to address this to. I'll just toss it out there. Senator Baucus is co-sponsoring a bill that would make agencies, in short, coordinate better their response to climate change. How effective would a measure like that be, or is it strictly window dressing?
Well, I think it would be very effective. Every bit could help. We need the Bureau of Land Management. We need the Forest Service, who are our federal agencies that manage some of the biggest bird habitats in the western U.S., to really step up and recognize that this is going to be one of their future, if not current, duties, is to begin working in anticipation of climate change and making sure they do everything they can in terms of making good choices for how we'll cope with a hotter, drier planet in the future.
President Obama last week promised a renewed effort to combat climate change. But between, Steve, the IRS and Benghazi, NSA and healthcare, do you think climate change will get lost in the shuffle or not?
Certainly, Ed, is a concern that it might get lost in the shuffle. But I guess the message that Ben and I want to make very clear and emphasize is that this is not something we can put off. We need to support political efforts by Baucus, by Obama, and policy efforts that are really going to confront the climate issue head on. And we need to be a world leader in climate policy. Ben mentioned solar panels, but you know, we need to take individual action, but we also need to take action at the federal level, the state level, the local level. This is not something that's going to go away. We can't turn our backs on this. The science is clear. There's been lots and lots of study, and we know that more carbon in our atmosphere is not the direction we need to be going. We need to find alternative energy sources. We need to conserve energy. We need to do everything possible to make our buildings more energy efficient, to make our cars more energy efficient. We need to support politicians and policy efforts that both Obama and Baucus are bringing forward.
One last question, and that would be take action, but take action at what cost? What is this going to cost industry and government and, in the end, you and me as consumers?
Yeah, I have to say that the cost of not doing anything is much, much higher than the cost of doing something, and there may be some economic costs in the short term. But in the long term, we're going to save a lot of money and a lot of resources if we do the right thing now. And with our economy starting to turn around, I think is a good time to be thinking about we can't just say, well, you know, let's wait and do something next year or next decade. We have to take action now. I mean, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been screaming loudly for the last decade that we're at the 11th hour here, and we really need to take action now. And that means individuals, that means local governments, state governments, national governments, and internationally, all countries need to step up to the plate, and we really need to do everything we can to move away from fossil fuels and go to alternative energies and energy conservation.
And Ben, you're on board with that?
Well, I am, and you know, one of the things we need to keep in mind is we can't always anticipate the future. Sometimes we get surprised by what the costs are or aren't of pursuing a particular energy type. Right now, for example, in the last year, the carbon footprint in the U.S. has been reduced, and that's because of a dramatic drop in the cost of natural gas. Who would have guessed that 5 years ago? So we know what puts carbon in our atmosphere. We know what types of energy don't. Clearly, we have to give those types that put less in the atmosphere a better chance and continue research and study and implement them where we can.
I've been speaking with Sage Grouse consultant Ben Diebel and Steve Hoffman, executive director of Montana Audubon. Fellas, I very much appreciate your all's time. Thanks for sharing your input.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers. Lows will be in the mid to upper 40s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with highs in the upper 70s to mid 80s. For central Montana, tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of thunderstorms. Lows will be around 50 degrees. Tomorrow expect sunny skies with highs around 75 to 85 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 40s. Tomorrow expect sunny skies with highs in the upper 80s. Currently in our listening area, Helena is 70 degrees with cloudy and windy conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 73 degrees. Butte has 69 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Great Falls is mostly cloudy and windy with 78 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under cloudy skies is 64 degrees. It's 76 and mostly cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 72 degrees. Libby has 68 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are cloudy and it's 72 degrees. And now for the editorial comment of Dina Mansour.
Mike Mansfield Center of the University of Montana pursues a dual mission, to foster mutual understanding between the people of the U.S. and Asia, as well as to foster ethics in public affairs. Over the past 30 years, we have developed a number of programs in support of this vision, always with the spirit of Mike Mansfield as the driving force in our programming. When thinking of Mike Mansfield in Asia, many observers tend to identify him with East Asia. This is largely as a result of his tenure as ambassador to Japan and role as a professor of Far Eastern history. However, throughout his years in the U.S. Senate, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos were of great concern to Mansfield. Soon after his election to the Senate in 1952, he began a series of fact-finding missions throughout the region and delivered a speech entitled "The Situation in Laos" on the Senate floor in June 1955, in which he raised concerns over Vietnamese incursions in Laos. Mansfield was heavily engaged in the region through initial strong support of Vietnam's Diem in the late 1950s, to evolving into open criticism of the Vietnam War in the late 1960s and early 1970s. In recent years, the Mansfield Center has had the opportunity to foster greater relations between Montanans and the people of the Lower Mekong Delta, primarily those of Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. Laos in particular seems to hold the lure for many of our Montana exchange participants. People laugh when I say this, but Montana is similar to Laos in so many ways. Like Montana, Laos is landlocked, with a largely rural population of just under 7 million people, the least populous country in the region. Laos features mountains and rivers and relies on natural resources for its income through mining, logging, agriculture, ecotourism, and dams. The people are kind and generous, just like Montanans. Laos became engaged in the Vietnam War as parts of the country were occupied by North Vietnam for use as a supply route. As a result, Laos became the most heavily bombed country in the world per capita, with an estimated 270 million bombs dropped on the country by the U.S. Of those bombs, about a third remain as unexploded ordnance. As made abundantly clear during former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit to Laos 1 year ago, the U.S. has an enduring legacy in Laos. Visiting an artificial limb center, Secretary Clinton met 19-year-old Pongsavat Sonilya, who lost his forearms and eyesight when a U.S. bomb exploded just 3 years ago. In broadening relationships between the U.S. and Laos, we've been fortunate to promote travel by both students and professionals in fields ranging from the sciences to economic development. Through our exchanges, we've become strong partners with the first non-governmental, non-profit organization created in Laos, the Participatory Development Training Center, or PDET. PDET's origins trace back to 1980, when its founder began a program to support food security for poor rural communities. PDET has evolved toward a greater mission to support sustainable development and poverty reduction. PDET's founder is Sombat Sompon, the eldest son of a poor farming family who experienced poverty and hunger, fleeing temporarily to Thailand to escape the war. He eventually earned a scholarship to study education and agriculture, returning to Laos to improve the lives of poor farmers. Sombat received numerous awards for his work, including the Asian equivalent of the Nobel Prize, the Magsaysay Award. In a stark reminder of the state of human rights in Laos, Sombat disappeared 6 months ago as he and his wife were driving separately from his office in Vientiane to their home. A police security video shows him being stopped at a police checkpoint and taken into custody. Despite attention from international observers, the Lao government has failed to explain his disappearance. As the U.S. Embassy in Vientiane stated, Mr. Sombat is widely admired for his peaceful and constructive focus on improving his country. Continued inaction on this case by the Lao authorities could erode progress made over the past years and damage the country's international reputation, potentially raising additional questions about the Lao government's commitment to uphold the rule of law and engage responsibly with the world. As the Mansfield Center pursues its dual mission, we stand together with the friends and family of Sombat as they work to facilitate his return. As we maintain our relationships with governmental and non-governmental organizations in Laos, we work to educate colleagues on Sombat's disappearance with the hope that he will soon be returned. To learn about our continuing engagement with Laos and more about Sombat, please see our website at umt.edu/Mansfield. On behalf of the Mansfield Center, I'm Dina Mansour.
Dina Mansour is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.